Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with 96-year-old George Wicks, born in Rochester, New York, a longtime professor of English literature at the University of Oregon in Eugene, an accomplished writer whose work has been trumpeted by George Plimpton, among others. But during World War II, George Wicks was part of a secretive intelligence agency that would eventually become the CIA. It was born in those tumultuous years as the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, and his first duty in the organization was as a cryptographer in our nation's capital.
During my time in Washington, the invasion of Europe was proceeding, and naturally, everyone, actually not only people who were in the Army, was following it very closely. For anyone, that was a gripping matter going on every day. Now, that was not part of my job. It was just something I'd read papers and listen to the radio, watch newsreels, that sort of thing. So you were always conscious of the war. And once in the Army, you were conscious of the war, if you were conscious at all. In fact, you worried about being part of the D-Day invasion. At one point, they were grabbing up soldiers from all over the place. And I'd had infantry training, so I was the good candidate for being shipped to England and taking part in the Normandy invasion.
And the OSS had a heavy involvement in Europe behind enemy lines. They could have assigned you to something like that. But as far as those messages that you're sending and receiving, coded messages, can you give us an example of what the subject nature might be, what those messages contained, or why it was important for them to be encoded?
Well, it was all, most of the OSS activity was secret. They were in the process of gathering intelligence, military intelligence, and organizing strategy because they had operations going on all over the world. At that time, when I was in Washington, D.C., we were mostly aware of what was going on in Europe. But then later, when I was sent to Southeast Asia, there was another war going on there. But again, OSS was very active there. So we'd be sending messages. It could be about anything, about supplies, about strategy, about people moving back and forth, or intelligence about enemy activities, that sort of thing.
And as far as the secret aspect of this, the importance of keeping those secrets, was there a way that they communicated that or underscored that or helped you understand the gravity of that secrecy, why it was so crucial?
Oh, yes. That's one of the first things you learned. There was a whole gradation. Things went from confidential to top secret to eyes alone, messages that were only supposed to be read by one person. So there were different orders of secrecy. Confidential meant you could probably talk about this when you go home. But anything secret or top secret, you never talked about. And you were made very security conscious.
Did you have a desire to go overseas? Were you content to stay in Washington, D.C.? Did you have any feelings about that, about what the OSS did with you?
Yes, I definitely wanted to go overseas. I didn't want to be a code clerk in the basement of the Senate Brewery all through for the rest of the war.
And that's what happened. So tell me about that. Where did you go and what was that all about?
I was shipped out to California again, but this time I knew where I was going. I was shipped overseas from Riverside, which, if you know, California is rather far inland. That was my port of embarkation. But the sea is not that far away, and they put me on a new troop ship that traveled by itself. This was a new development. For 35 days, we traveled across the Pacific and under Australia to avoid any likelihood of Japanese attack. The troop ship was fast, and it could outrun any likely Japanese ship. And we were far enough away so that there was no danger of aerial attack, I think. So for 35 days, went on this lovely cruise on a beautiful new ship.
Did you know anything about your assignment or where your destination was going to be?
I think I knew that I was going to Calcutta. OSS had a big message center in Calcutta. It covered a whole area of Southeast Asia. And I didn't know whether I was going to end up there, but I knew that that was the first place I would go, and that's where we landed.
And what'd you do there?
Same thing I'd been doing in Washington, only now it was with the field. And we were communicating with people who were out in action, mainly in Burma, somewhat in Saigon, and there were people flying over the hump too into China, but there was an OSS unit in China that covered its own territory. We only got them as far as the hump, and from then on they went on to Kunming or wherever. Julia Child was with OSS in China, you know.
Yeah. Did she ever cook anything for you?
I never met her. I taught at Harvard one summer, and she was just over the back fence, but didn't seem to be there that summer. So we never met Julia Child. But you know, the OSS medal has a figure of a woman in disguise. Have you ever looked at it? Well, I say that's Julia Child. That's a piece of top secret information that I'm divulging here. This is a guy parachuting because most of the OSS parachuted and had parachute training. I never had that, even though I was at Fort Benning, Georgia, which was the parachute school. And I, in a way, regret that I didn't. And then this guy wearing a top hat must be a spy, disguised as a civilian.
Well, and you mentioned that, and I think that might be something to explain to people, because if folks have never heard of the OSS, I'm sure they've heard of the CIA, which succeeded the OSS, but they might not understand how some of these operations work. So you're there in Calcutta in this message center, but there are operators, both American and natives or locals or from other countries, who are carrying out top secret missions. How aware would you be of what those missions were or what was happening?
You were very aware of them because you were communicating about them. You were in touch with operations in the field. And you were following, for instance, what was going on in Burma particularly, which was a very active place at that time, where units of OSS were fighting the Japanese, along with British units and others.
Maybe this is a hard one to answer because you're one man, but I know you're familiar with the bigger picture. How significant was the contribution of the OSS to what eventually happened in World War II? How do you understand that contribution?
I can give you an example, one man's mission. My commanding officer in Saigon, Peter Dewey, parachuted into France and met up with some resistance. This was all planned. You see, they had communicated beforehand. This is an OSS operation. He and a few others, one of them was the son of Ernest Hemingway, who parachuted in with a fly rod because he was going to live on the trout of France.
Now, what would a modern literature professor know about Ernest Hemingway, though?
You can't help it. Might know too much about Ernest Hemingway. They captured a German staff car and drove around in it, I don't know how they managed this, for a considerable period, sending information back. Now, this is just before the invasion from North Africa, the invasion of southern France. They obtained information about activities on the Rhine, all kinds of information. This is just one little operation.
And this would become your boss, your commanding officer,
yes.
Dewey. So you're saying that particular mission, one thing that he did and spearheaded, informed the invasion of Europe.
Yes, yes. And that's the kind of intelligence gathering operation that they did during the war. And I've just been reading a book about the invasion, the D-Day, preparation for the D-Day by a French organization that fed information to MI6 in London. They gave them all kinds of information about German submarine bases, for instance, and the development of the rockets in Northern Europe. So this kind of intelligence was terribly important for any large-scale military activity or even small-scale military activity.
Important and also extremely dangerous. And how was it that you came to work with Dewey? When did you first meet him?
I met him in Rangoon. You know, one of the guys in the message center said, there's somebody here who's going to lead the mission to Saigon, and you ought to interview him. So I did. I went to Major Dewey, as he was then. He's always referred to as Colonel Dewey because he became a colonel overnight, the way OSS people did. I became a lieutenant then, you see. I said, I would like to go to Saigon with you. I studied the language. He was unimpressed. He said, yes, but do you know French? And I said, French is my first language. All right, he said, what is the French word for street? So I said, rue. He said, all right, you can go. Turn up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And when I turned up at 3 o'clock in the morning, he pinned lieutenant's bars on me. And then I started impersonating an officer, for which I was cashiered many months later when the Army found out about it.
So your test for promotion was pronouncing one word correctly, and probably a lot of people failed that test.
Well, I don't think he gave that test to very many people. Peter Dewey, who spoke faultless French himself, was looking for French speakers on his mission, and he'd gone all over the theater looking for French speakers, hadn't had much success, because we were going to be dealing with the French in Indochina. So it was essential that some of us at least be able to speak the language. OSS sent a mission to Saigon and another to Hanoi to cover what was going on. Now, this was gathering political intelligence rather than military intelligence, because there was no State Department representation in all of Southeast Asia, and we were a kind of an advanced team sent to report back to Washington on whatever was happening, and also to look after American interests. But I always felt that our chief purpose really was to report on the political situation. And Saigon, for instance, was a hub of intrigue. There were Chinese and Cambodian, and there were all kinds of people, operatives there. It was sort of like a movie set. If you've seen The Quiet American, you have a sense of what, that's a very good, Graham Greene was there 5 months after we were, and he describes it perfectly. Hanoi was under the control of the Vietnamese. They were really, and they were setting up their own government. Ho Chi Minh declared independence from Hanoi. Well, OSS mission in Hanoi was in daily touch with him. They were very close, and one of my friends in the Vietnamese group was in the jungle with Ho while the war was still going on, because they were in action against the Japanese, guerrilla action.
And you would have some personal interaction with him as well. What precipitated that, and what was the purpose of your meeting with Ho Chi Minh?
Well, I didn't meet with Ho Chi Minh until later. This is a mission that another guy and I cooked up. I should explain that I spent 4 months in Saigon, and then our commanding officer was killed, and we all were interviewed, signed depositions, and I signed myself, name and rank, at theater headquarters when it heard this. Who is this Lieutenant Wicks? So that's when I was cashiered at OSS to save face, and my face as well, called me back to our theater headquarters in Singapore, where the commanding officer said, now, where would you like to go next? I can offer you Batavia, Jakarta, or Bangkok. Well, I knew I wanted to go to Bangkok, and so I went to Bangkok for 6 wonderful weeks. I got there in a peculiar fashion. The legation, as it was then, the first State Department representation in Bangkok was beginning. Wasn't anywhere in Vietnam or anywhere else, I think, in Southeast Asia. Anyhow, so they wanted to ship an old Plymouth painted in olive drab camouflage for use by the embassy. No American cars in Bangkok at this time. They loaded it on a freighter, a tramp steamer, and loaded me on too, and that was my mission, to escort this car. Well, tramp steamers are trafficking all along the way. This one stopped off in Saigon, what do you know, for Christmas. And I saw my old friends, one of them and I, cooked up this mission of going to Hanoi. We wanted to go to Hanoi to see what was going on. We sent a message back. He was a major, so he had pull. I sent a message back to OSS Washington about going to Hanoi to interview Ho Chi Minh and see if he was a communist. Well, everyone, of course, knew that Ho Chi Minh was a communist. In retrospect, I think, because there was no, the OSS mission to Hanoi had ended in October. This is, by this time, we're at the end of December. And I think OSS Washington wanted to know what was going on in Hanoi, this new government forming and all that. So they said, yes, you go to Hanoi and ask Ho Chi Minh if he's a communist, which we did eventually. I had to go from Bangkok with a radio operator up to Hanoi, and Frank went from Saigon to, well, anyhow, we met up in Hanoi and spent some time there and watched the French arrive in Hanoi in the beginning of the war there, in fact.
Was that the extent of your interview with Ho Chi Minh? Are you a communist? Yes, and see you later?
He said, yes, I'm a communist. Well, the second question was, will your country be communist? Because this is the time when this country, the Cold War, was one of the things that shocked me when I got back to the U.S. after the war, was how hysterical the country was about communism. And that had a lot to do, by the way, with what happened in our relations with Ho Chi Minh.
Here in the 1940s, could you see something coming down the road? Did you have any idea or any inclination that America would end up getting involved in that part of the world?
No, and it was insane, particularly insane after the Vietnamese beat the French army at Dien Bien Phu. You could see that a military campaign such as this country would conduct wouldn't work against a population and an entire population that wanted its independence. We understood a lot of this, but convincing Washington was another matter. We could see a lot of what was coming, and all of us in OSS were sympathetic with the Vietnamese desire for independence.
If you watched Ken Burns' 18-hour PBS documentary on the Vietnam War, you may have seen Professor Wicks discussing those 1940s observations in Southeast Asia. But there was an event there he touched on that I think we need to hear more about. What happened to Peter Dewey? And how close did George Wicks come to losing his own life? Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.